If you can actually effectively communicate like that, you're going to be a much more effective financial planner in your work. A huge gap for us is we have all this technical language and people don't really get it. It's an emotional thing, much more than a logical thing. And so to find ways to really meet people where they live is so important if you want to be effective.
I'm Ian Harvey from New York City, and you're listening to You're a Financial Planner, Now What? The podcast to help you fast track your career by bringing you meaningful conversations on topics that influence new financial planners, their careers, and the lives of their clients.
Once again, we're excited to have Dr. Brad Klontz on the show. It's been just over 100 episodes since he was last with us, and today he joins us for a dive into the power of effective communication and the simple act of listening as a financial planner. Coming up, Dr. Brad joins host Hannah to discuss how you can motivate clients, the role emotion plays in the profession, and how he's spreading the truth through social media. Today's episode is brought to you by Markle. As an investment advisor, you know even the littlest detail can make a huge impact, such as those tiny footnotes in the back of a prospectus or annual report. For your firm's professional insurance coverage, the details are also important. That's why your firm needs insurance coverage developed for financial service professionals to protect you, your firm, and your assets. Markle's Investment Advisors Program offers errors and omissions and directors and officers insurance. They've insured our industry and profession for 3 decades and have a strong reputation within our community as a result of its industry expertise, stable premiums, and excellent claims management services. Markle is proud to be the choice of thousands of financial service professionals. Contact your insurance broker or agent today to get a quote from Markle.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Brad.
Yes, very happy to be back.
So I am so glad you're here. And I always find every time I talk to you, I feel like I learn something new. And because you bring this unique aspect of the financial psychology to financial planning, one thing that I've been really, really curious and thinking about a lot, especially as we've been looking at our internal processes for how we do financial planning, is a language around what we do, how we talk about financial planning and what we mean by it versus what our clients are actually perceiving. I think it's fair to say that there's a gap often between our perception and our client's perception on that.
I think that's entirely accurate.
Are there conditions that are necessary for a client to step foot into a financial planner's office?
Yeah, there are. And there's quite often a context too. And that context typically involves some sort of transition or stressor that they're facing. So, you know, whether it's approaching retirement, this is a transitional stressor, whether it's a divorce, whether it's, you know, we're going to have a child, we need to start thinking more seriously about our finances, or sometimes it's they're not happy with their previous financial advisor. There's usually some sort of impetus that is leading them to go look for you or to seek you. So that's something to really be aware of too, that there's quite often a lot of emotion associated with that. Some of it's positive, some of it's negative, some of it could be fear, but that's quite often where we're seeing people walk in the door.
You said that there's emotion connected to when people are coming in. How do the best planners address that? And then where do you see that other planners kind of fall short in that?
Yeah. So that's just such an insightful question in and of itself. So on all my advisors in my firm, I have encourage them to put a little sticky note on their computer screen or put it somewhere where they can see it just before a client meeting. And it says 75-25. And the mission and the goal is to listen 75% of the time and talk 25% of the time. And in our work with advisors, it's typically flipped the other direction. And because we're human beings. And when a client comes in, some of us are eager. Some of us might be a little bit stressed, especially if we're new. And when we're in that state of mind, we have a tendency to want to, educate the client or present ourselves in the best light. We're really focused on ourselves ultimately. So we're having our own emotional experience. And so we're really hyper-focused on ourselves. And that little cue is to remind us to focus on the client. Because if we can do that, we're going to be giving the client a much better emotional experience of us, frankly. So, it has a real benefit of them feeling more connected to us, them feeling more understood, and just creating that space for them to talk about what they're dealing with and what they're coming in with. And it's a bit of a dance and a bit of an art, because you'll have some clients who are expecting that formal presentation. And so they'll put that pressure on you, which is fine. And so you want to meet them right there. But I always like to start meetings with, so we've got this set of things we want to talk about, I want to share with you. But before we do that, it'd be great if you could just share with me, what's the top thing on your mind right now? What's most concerning you? and just creating some space for them to bring whatever it is into the room. And I've certainly sat with people where I have this whole agenda. I'm going to go over whatever it is, you know, our models, portfolio models or whatever. And I've said that to somebody and they have reported something that was totally shocking to me. Like they had just lost their, you know, sibling the night before or some really profound life event. So they're bringing all this emotion in related to this. And if I just jumped into business, I wouldn't have created some space to hear what's actually going on and what's most important in that moment.
Are clients getting what they need when they go to our websites to know to even call us?
I think we do a really poor job on the websites too, in general. like, you know, what percentage of your clients, you know, their goal in life is to be on a sailboat. So could we just take all the sailboats off our websites? Like maybe we could start there. It's just sort of that, sort of a disconnect. And a lot of, I think what we do that, so we're getting into a little bit of the marketing component and the psychology of marketing and all of that. And we're entirely too self-focused on our websites. It's all about what I'm doing and what I have to offer you and who we are and who I am. And I think the websites that, and the communications that are a little bit more effective are ones that are more client-centered. So it's more asking like, you know, what, tell us about you, what's stressing you out, and really coming at it from that direction around what we would anticipate our prototypical clients' needs are in that time. Are you know, are you worried about retirement? You know, these are the types of questions you can have on your front page, worried about retirement, not knowing what to do with those stock options. I mean, you're sort of hitting them at their pain point, which happens to be a fabulous marketing technique, but it's also one that really helps people relate to that person on a level that they're really concerned about. It's top of mind for them and it's focused on the client versus yourself.
So you mentioned that 75 and 25% rule or sticky note that you put on your on the computer. How do we give advice in those situations? Like how is it best for us, because we are the experts on the financial aspects of the plan, what's the best way for us to give advice in a way that's going to be received and then acted upon?
Before we talk about that, it's also really important to know that clients are, and we know this, but it's something to really think about, that when somebody's walking in our door, especially if they're a new client, haven't worked with an advisor before, just understand that there's probably a lot of shame that they're walking in with, or concern that they're going to be judged, or potential embarrassment. So there's a lot of stress in actually coming to see you to begin with. Now, you might be sort of immune to this because you're like, well, I talk about this every day. But just reminding yourself that this is, for many people, the most, one of the most intimate areas of their life. They don't talk to anyone else about. They might be talking to their friends about their sex life, but they never talk about their financial life. So just understanding that this is a very, very sensitive topic for people and they don't talk about it much. And there's a real fear of being judged, you know? So they're coming to you, this expert, they're laying out their most vulnerable parts of themselves that they don't share with anyone else. And so just understanding that, real responsibility we have and that on position of honor that we have, that clients are coming in and talking about what is potentially the thing that is stressing them out the most, keeping them up at night, and leading to most of the stress in their lives, which all the studies have shown. This is the biggest stressor in people's lives. So just understanding that and just being consistently aware of this very honored place we are and the trust people are putting into us is a great place to start with that. And then when it comes to advice, you know, I talked a lot about advice giving and the advice I give is don't give advice, you know, if you've ever heard me talk, but that's not really true. So our job is to give advice. Our job is to answer questions that clients ask us. Our job is to do our due diligence based on our assessment around recommendations, and recommendations are advice. Like I'm going to suggest you do these things. So doing it in a really, you know, people have no problem giving advice, frankly. So this is something we do quite naturally. The hard part is recognizing when somebody is not taking that advice or they're resisting that advice. And this becomes a bit of a course of study around, you know, what does resistance look like? And if you happen to be in a romantic relationship, you can see indicators of resistance probably every day in your life. And so that's a great place to start. It's sort of noticing like, if I'm making a suggestion and somebody starts to resist it, what are the signs? You know, it can be nonverbal signs where they're sort of crossing their arms or they're sort of shifting away from you, or they have an expression on their face of one that looks like surprise or consternation. Or it could be a verbal indicator of some resistance to that advice where they start saying yes, but, or they argue back with you a little bit. And one of the key skills, if you want to be effective in your work with clients, is to not do what you're naturally going to want to do when they resist that advice. And what you're naturally going to want to do is sort of double down, repeat yourself, throw up some extra graphs, your charts, and try to educate that person into submission around your advice. And what we know by the science is all that backfires. So the more you do that, the less likely it is for that person to take that advice. And so the cue is really to stop what you're doing. And the best technique is to just sort of simply reflect back what that person is saying. So for example, hey, you know, Hannah, you need to get a will. Well, you know, and then you say something like, well, and then whatever you say after that, my job is to just listen and then sort of repeat that back to you and say, so you're kind of concerned about the timing around that, or you're worried that you can't really have that conversation with your partner because of the complication, whatever it is, whatever that resistance is, just sort of reflect that back versus me saying, but Hannah, you know, you really need a will, right? Because then what's going to happen is you're going to start rehearsing the reasons why you're not ready to get a will. And then I'm going to say, but you really need to. And what the studies have shown is you're less likely to get a will if I take that approach than if I had never talked to you about a will to begin with.
I was just having a conversation with some planners this week, and they were frustrated because their clients weren't implementing their advice. So is this what's happening? Is this a narrative that's likely going on in their mind?
Absolutely. And our job is to give advice. Our job is to give good advice frequently. but it's paying attention to that resistance. And we're all going to get it, right? The best advisors are going to get it. Actually, the clients who are the best clients are going to give us some resistance along the way at some point. Some people are ready to come in and do one thing, and we're asking them to do six other things. Maybe they're not ready to do some of that. And that was part of your question, like, how do we know when people are ready to do it? Well, we're all at different stages of change in our lives around everything. Like, we might be really ready to exercise more, but we're not ready to really make those dietary changes. It's pretty normal to be in that. So it's being sensitive to those particular pieces of advice and paying close attention to whether a client's resisting that or executing on it. And then shifting your tactics. Because again, it's totally natural to try to double down on your advice. We're all wired to do that. And it's interrupting your natural response to sort of step back and just sort of sit with that client around their resistance. The studies show that's where you're going to get more effective movement too.
I'm sure there's a study out there, but I remember hearing that only like 10% of people are ever ready to change at any certain point. Is there anything that we can do as advisors to help our clients want to change, or to help them to get to that place where they're ready to make that change? Like you said, if they're ready to make those dietary changes on top of the exercising.
Yeah. Well, the great news is it's not half as bad. Well, it's twice as good as you think it is. It's 20% of people are.
Oh, good.
Are sort of, yes, exactly. So woo, what a relief, you know, but so that's 1 out of 5 that are just totally ready and prepared, and they're going to take your advice. You know, and some planners screen out all the rest of the people. So some planners are really sort of in your face around, this is what we do. This is how we do it. Clients who work with us, this is how they want it. That might not be a good fit for you. So make your decision. And that's fine. I mean, you're going to screen out, you know, there's a lot of, you'll lose a lot of business, right? but you'll definitely get the clients who are ready to drink the Kool-Aid you're stirring and making up. So there are those clients that are right there. But some people just, so this is to that stages of change. So that's the action phase. So that's about 20% of the people are just ready to just execute on whatever advice you're giving them, or every one particular piece of advice. The rest of people are in the, either they're contemplating it, they're thinking about it, they're getting ready to do it, they're just not ready to pull the trigger, or they're sort of in total denial that this is something they need even to address. And this is what makes financial planning so exciting and so fun, because we're not salespeople. So it's not, I'm just going to try to make this sale and then off you go. You know, my goal as a financial planner is to be with you for years or decades and to be focused on your financial health. And so the way I see it is, it's not my job to, so I've given you 10 recommendations. I was going to say 25, but a lot of people have wised up and given less, you know, or even better, I'm giving you 3 or 4. And, you know, But I might have 15 more. We're just not ready to do it. And I know we're not ready to do it. And I know I'm going to be meeting with you again in a month or 3 months. And I'll mention that we have more to address in this area, but let's do this first. Or where do you want to start first? You know, like, for example, one thing that you'll see a lot of resistance on with clients, and I'm sure you've seen this too, but it's the data collection, right? It's like, hey, so, you know, part of what we do is we do an analysis of your insurance needs and that kind of thing. So how about if you upload all 16 policies into our portal, you know, all 16 30-page policies, and then, you know, have that done by next week, right? I don't know if you've ever had a client who actually did it within a week. Maybe you have some engineer clients, but a lot of people will avoid that. And it's just something that it's not necessarily that they're resistant to that resistance or that insurance concept. It's just that they're busy or they're, and so the more you confront somebody around that, the worse it's going to go. So just being gentle and understanding that it's a process, I think, really helps. And that's the way I look at my work with clients is, you know, I'm hoping to be working with them for decades to come. So this is something that can be rolled out over time. And, you know, no big surprise to you, but in my firm, you know, one of the things we talk about is financial psychology. So we do asset management, we do financial planning, we do financial psychology. Those are sort of our three offerings. I don't make clients, for example, who are coming in who want just asset management. This is also really another important point in working with people. If you have to sort of meet them where they're at. So I believe firmly that they need a financial plan. This is just sort of a value I have. I think everybody needs one or would benefit from one. But if somebody comes in the door and all they want is asset management, I'm not going to tell them, well, you got to do financial plan right now. Well, I don't really want to do that. Well, you have to. So for me personally, and I learned this as years and years of work as a clinical psychologist, you know, when somebody's coming in with an issue or a problem, they're not ready to do everything you want them to do in session one, right? And so, and if you come at them like they need to, it's not only not effective, it's also a bit shaming for them and it's not connecting with them. So I'm a real big proponent of meeting a client with where they're at. And of course I have this agenda and I have these ideas on what they need to do, but I'm looking at this as a process. So I'm looking at moving them a step or two further towards that action phase, not going from they've never heard of this to taking action in one meeting. And I think that's a great way to feel like a failure as a financial planner, but looking at it as more of a process.
It's interesting. I think of the seven steps of financial planning. What you're talking about is the process of financial planning, but it doesn't fit necessarily in these nice, neat boxes.
Yes. A lot of things in life don't seem to quite fit in the box, right? Fabulous model. I love the stages. And any practicing financial planner knows too that you might be missing some data points, you know, that come to light later, or even a client who is giving you misinformation or information they hadn't really thought through. And so that's a process that is a live one. It's a dynamic one. And financial planners who've been doing this for a long time know that financial planning is a lifelong process. It's not a document mm-hmm. you lay in front of somebody 2 weeks later.
So on that data collection example that you gave, you said to, you know, be gentle and be patient with them on that. Are there other approaches to help? I mean, in that specific, I'm selfishly asking this for my practice actually right now. Are there other techniques or things that we can do to help with that? Or is it just the fundamental issue of we're asking too much of our clients?
Yeah, I think we need to be good at sort of assessing their capacity for delivering what we're wanting in the mm-hmm. time frame in which we're wanting it. So just understand this too. If you're getting resistance from your client, you're the one creating it. Okay? You're creating it, okay? Yeah. So you're creating the situation where they're not wanting to deliver what you're wanting them to deliver. So just owning that can be really helpful because you can then sort of shift your approach. But this is some of the stuff we've talked about previously too, where finding other ways of presenting information to clients can be extremely beneficial. And this is where the work in experiential type models really comes into play. So you can think about having people, for example, you want to talk about their retirement. So the typical way of doing that would be in your little questionnaire, hey, what year do you want to retire? How much money do you want to have when you retire? That's sort of like the old school way of doing it. Hopefully I'm not offending anyone by saying that's the old school way. I mean, go ahead and ask those questions. Don't get me wrong. But I think a much more powerful approach to actually move people towards motivation is to have them get a little bit more specific and engage the parts of their brain that are really the ones that are driving behaviors, which is that emotional, visual, what we would call the animal brain, the mammalian brain, the emotional brain, to try to activate that part of the part of the individual around any sort of these behavioral change issues, because that's the part of the brain that really gets people to take action. And so how do you do that? Well, one way you might do that is adding to your question set around retirement. You know, tell me, paint a picture of your ideal retirement for me. Now, that's a very different question. Wow. And even as I say that question, I start to picture my ideal retirement. And so I might say, you know, flesh it out for me. Like, who's there? What do you see yourself doing? Where are you? Extremely, that technique right there, if you wanted to increase somebody's motivation to save for retirement, is incredibly powerful. We recently did a clinical trial on using that type of an experience. For this one, we did had people create vision boards of their savings goals. And just after doing that for an hour, we saw a 73% increase in savings rates as a percentage of gross income. And we compared that to putting people in a room where we were doing more of that educational component that most financial planners do around educating people around the importance of retirement or saving for retirement and all that kind of thing. So, but bringing in those emotional parts, we saw a 73% increase in savings after just an hour of doing that. And so a fabulous way to get people to move forward around some of these goals is to find ways to make it more visual, more emotional, more kinesthetic, really going after those parts of the brain that motivate behavioral change.
Number one, what's our role as a financial planner in terms of motivation? Is it our job to help motivate our clients? And then number two, how does motivation work? Like what is like the psychology behind that that we need to understand as planners?
Yeah. So first of all, I would say yes. So motivation is basically like this impetus to take action, right? So we want to increase the motivation for our clients to do what's in their best financial health. So yes, it's absolutely part of our job. Just a quick example, if you see a client who is engaging in a self-destructive financial behavior, for example, something we quite commonly see is people who are perhaps financially enabling somebody else. So they're giving money in a way that's hurting either themselves or hurting somebody else. This is a real common example that advisors run into. Part of what we want to do is to motivate them to stop doing that, you know, or do it in a different way. And so absolutely, that's part of our job. We're going to be running into this stuff all the time as that primary source of financial health help for a client throughout their lifespan. So these sorts of circumstances pop up all the time. And so in that sense, we wrote an article in the Journal of Financial Planning a few years back, really sort of talking about financial planner as healer, which is an interesting concept. But at least I think it's interesting. But as a healer, and what do I mean by that? I mean, financial stress is the biggest source of stress in people's lives in America. Okay. So the studies have shown anywhere from 70 to 80% of Americans say it's the biggest source of stress in their lives, above work, children, health, everything. And what we know is stress kills people. That's the other thing we know. We know that most people are stressed about money and stress kills people. And then That brings me to the question of who do these stressed out people around money, who do they talk to? Who do they go to for help? And they don't go to the mental health profession, okay? So, and we've done research on this too. Mental health profession has a tendency to be money avoidant. As part of their intake process, it might surprise you, they don't ask any questions about money. They don't ask, do you have debt? Are you stressed about money? It's not even part of the training. So who do they go to talk about this issue? I'm going to suggest it's financial planners. And so it's not a big leap to say money's the biggest source of stress. Money kills people. The only professional that a person can talk to around money is probably a financial planner. So you are actually a lifesaver. You are actually in a position to literally save lives around, hopefully I'm not coming across like too adamant about it, but I truly believe this on a very deep level. We are in a position to help people heal what is the most stressful and painful thing in their lives. And it's a huge opportunity for us. It's a call to action. It's sort of a mission, I believe, that we're potentially on earth here to do. And it's incredibly valuable. So really coming at it from that point of view is it's quite inspiring for me. And I hope it is for you.
I've been seeing a lot of financial coaching versus financial planning. What do you see as kind of the differences between a financial coach and a financial planner?
So what I see with a financial planner, I would say, is if we're going to categorize them like this, is probably more traditionally trained. So as part of your curriculum and training, you're learning about insurance planning and estate planning and educational planning. You come out with a bunch of information, extremely valuable information that people need to know about, some tools on how to do financial plans, that kind of thing. But it sort of stops there. It's like, this is what we need. This is how we deliver this information to people. This is how we might construct a portfolio, that kind of thing. Nuts and bolts. But it doesn't really give you many tools on what to do when people just don't want to do it or they're showing some resistance, or you're in a room with a couple and they don't agree about their financial goals. Okay, what am I supposed to do with that? Or as the example we used before, people are taking advantage of them around money, and what are you supposed to do about that? So the coaching aspect is really bringing in what we've learned from psychology and using that and adopting some of those tools and techniques in the role of financial planner so that you can become more effective in your work. And that's ultimately what you're trying to do. In that aspect too, you're not doing psychotherapy on clients, right? So this isn't, you're not jumping off into trying to treat a mental disorder, you know, the more that therapy type, experience with people. That's not your mandate. That's not your job. But what you are doing is bringing in that knowledge around perhaps like beliefs around money or money scripts, like a lot of the research we've done. Like what was it like for them growing up around money, and how is that impacting their behaviors right now? How are they relating as a couple? You know, and again, you're not a couples therapist, but the thing that couples are most likely to fight about and get divorced about in the early years of marriage is money. So you're going to run across these conflicts. And what do I do? What do I do when I see that? If you're not trained with some coaching skills, you probably might ignore it. If you are, you might feel a little bit more comfortable to sit there and say, well, could we just take turns? And so we can just hear, I'd love to hear what your goals are. And I'd love to hear what your goals are. And you might feel like you could actually facilitate them negotiating a solution. And you're going to feel more like you have a skill set to do that. And again, that's not couples therapy. You're just helping people negotiate and using some of your listening skills. And a lot of that comes down to listening and change type technology skills. So that's what I see financial coaching. I hope, you know, my dream would be all financial planners are doing some type of financial coaching. You know, they're not, and perhaps they're doing it exactly the way they're doing business right now, but they're bringing in some of those questions and some of those tools and some of those strategies and theories in their work. And ultimately, it's just going to make them more effective. And being more effective is actually potentially never been more important than it is right now in the time which our profession is being threatened by all sorts of things, where, for example, asset management, you know, is being somewhat commoditized, and there's all kinds of downward pressure on fees. And I mean, isn't trading free in America right now? fees. Yeah. I mean, so there's all this downward pressure on price, and we've got a generation that's coming up that's very comfortable just never meeting with a human being around major aspects of their lives. And so I think it's a huge opportunity, but also somewhat of a mini crisis around how can we step into being more of that life-centered planner, that trusted advisor. And people need this, by the way. A robot's not going to help you solve all your problems in life, especially these deeply held emotional ones, at least not yet. So I think it helps as a market differentiator. It's also going to, you know, clients, when you listen to a client on a very deep level, if you're doing that 75-25, just understand, nobody else in their life is doing that. And for some people, if they've never gone and seen a psychotherapist, they have never had anyone listen to them for like 75% of the time in a meeting. This is such a unique experience in people's lives that if you just are able to create that space, people are going to become addicted to you, basically, because they're going to feel heard and understood, and which happens to be an incredibly beneficial experience for people on a psychological level and emotional level. So you're providing a tremendous value by creating that space for people. And also, it's going to be an incredibly sticky relationship because you're giving them an experience that is very rare, that they don't get in their personal life, that perhaps they've never gotten. And so therein lies the opportunity by bringing in some of that coaching skill set to make you much more effective and to have clients who never leave you.
As you were talking, the question came to mind, especially as you're talking about helping clients kind of be that mediator or, you know, have those conversations. At what point do we cross into the therapy side where it's just inappropriate for financial planners to be?
Yes. I'd love to show you my decision tree that I created related to this because it is such a complicated issue. Well, I should say it's an important issue. It's a very important issue. And coming from the clinical psychology side, it's really easy for me to tell. But I've been in your position and it's really tough. Like where am I getting into, you know, when am I crossing that boundary? Which is a really important thing. We know this from our own ethics as a profession. Like we shouldn't be doing stuff that we're not trained to do. Definitely we don't want to do that. And so the line that I've drawn and that I teach my students at Creighton is around when you're moving into the mental health world. And so, you know, what do I mean by that? It's where you're seeing that somebody who seems to be a little depressed, you know, everyone knows what depression looks like on a sort of a fundamental level, or you're seeing significant marital conflict, you know, and one person believes this, the other person believes that. Whatever you do, don't take a side. Okay. That would be a terrible marriage therapist too, who took a side on that.
Yeah.
So you want to avoid taking sides in that way. You want a more creative, open dialogue. And then you also want to avoid trying to, quote, treat some type of disorder. So for example, you see somebody who has an addiction to shopping or a compulsive spender. And maybe you've seen clients like that, or you've heard of clients like that, or somebody who has so much anxiety around money that you can kind of tell it's keeping them up at night and they're pretty rattled, or somebody who's got a gambling problem that seems to be out of their control, or a hoarder. I mean, there's a whole list of things, not to mention the more emotional, like somebody who's super anxious or depressed, or they're in the middle of a marital conflict that is heading for divorce. Those are the kind of things you want to stay away from. You don't want to ignore them because they're really, really important, but you also don't want to dive in there. It's crossing your boundary. Don't do it. Don't ever do it. And I say that in my role, I could do it, but in my role as a financial planner, I don't do it because it's also unethical for me to do it. It's totally unethical for me as a duly trained financial planner and psychologist to do both for one client. So I never do it. You can't put yourself in the position of a therapist with a client when you're managing their money. In our profession, in the psychology profession, it's called a dual role, and you can't do it. It's unethical. So those are boundaries that I keep for myself, even though I can do both. I never, you know, I do therapy on this side. I would never manage somebody's money I'm doing therapy with, and vice versa. But what you do want to do is you want to sort of be aware of these. I think it really does help to read up on many of these conditions I've just mentioned and just understand that they're there. And the other thing that's really exciting right now with the blend and the coaching and the therapy and all the stuff you've been reading about what's happening with the profession, actually the CFP board is bringing more psychology into a lot of their ways of conceptualizing our work too, which is really, really exciting, is to really find ways to connect with people who have that skill set. So if you don't want to do the nuts and bolts coaching kind of work and get into the weeds around budgeting details, that kind of stuff, maybe make a connection with somebody who that's what they do for a living. So they're a money coach, for example, and they help people around budgeting and they help people with that change, behavioral change stuff. And you can actually work with somebody who are like, hey, look, these are the goals that I have for this client. Here's the financial plan. Obviously you'd get consent from the client and work as a team. Could you help them move forward on some of these? So that would be one way to collaborate. Another way would be to have a relationship with a psychotherapist who is sensitive to money issues and somebody who perhaps has a specialty in that area. And there's a growing number of those individuals where in working with a client, you can make a referral. That's always a little bit of a sticky thing. It takes some skill to do that. You know, hey, you need a therapist. You know, don't do it that way. There does take some skill involved there. But that's another thing that a lot of planners are doing.
Yeah, I know. I've referred out clients to therapists. I'm just suggesting that it might be something that could help them through a rough patch.
Absolutely. By the way, how does that go? Have you had some success with that?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting because it usually causes them to pause and think. And they're just like, huh. I think it just expands their world a little bit, if that makes sense. They're like, Yep. Oh, I hadn't thought of that.
But have you lost clients by suggesting
that?
Oh,
gosh, no.
Yeah, yeah. So they're... No. So, because most of the resistance I get around that is around, oh my gosh, my clients are going to fire you. And if you do it wrong, they are going to fire you. But there's ways, you have to be sort of strategic around, you know, and opening that door and making that suggestion. I mean, you're referring them to perhaps an insurance specialist. So it's just another way of, and the more comfortable you are around it, the more comfortable they will be with having that discussion.
I've heard people say you can't take a client somewhere where you haven't gone. Is that true from a financial planning standpoint?
Well, I think that it's true in some aspects. You know, like, I don't think it's true in others. Like, I don't think you have to have run a medical practice, for example, in order to help advise somebody on the business structure of a medical practice, just as an example. But you, of course, have needed, you of course need some experience around business practices, right?
Yeah.
So in that sense, you have to have gone there. And I do think that if you're bringing in these skill sets from like the coaching world or the therapy world and you're adapting them, that's where I think it becomes much more important for you to, quote, have done your own work on that. And by that, I mean, if you want to engage with a client around their money scripts, for example, so their beliefs around money, like what was it like for you growing up around money? Or if you wanted to give them a test related to that, or you wanted to dive into a discussion around that, I think it's a really good idea for you to know your own.
Yeah.
I think it's a really good idea for you to have some insight on how your parents influenced your beliefs around money and how those beliefs around money have either helped you or hurt you throughout your life. And if they've hurt you, just have done some introspection around what you did to shift those. I think it's really good for you to have traveled some of that territory before you're bringing it in. So if you are bringing in, like, perhaps, for example, an exercise, like if you're going to give somebody a risk tolerance questionnaire, I think it's a good idea if you took it, you know, I mean, it's that sort of philosophy. Like, so, you know, the items, you know, that where people might get stuck around it, you have sort of a general philosophy, and you've also had the experience of having that experience yourself. Really, really valuable.
So let's talk a little bit more about money scripts. And I know you have done a lot of work around this. So what is a money script?
Yeah. So a money script is the word that we've used to describe these essentially subconscious beliefs we have about money. And I say subconscious because we don't talk about them much. So a lot of us aren't even aware that these are beliefs, you know, and it's something really interesting about even the word belief. It starts to become, it makes it a little bit more real and a little bit less than, you know, it separates yourself from it. So this is a belief that's been instilled in your brain around money. It doesn't mean it's right, you know, it doesn't mean it's accurate. But we have these beliefs. They're clunking around in our subconscious. And a lot of us aren't aware of them, but our research has shown that they have a direct relationship with people's income, net worth, credit card behaviors, you know, socioeconomic status in childhood, and a whole host of financial behaviors. So it's incredibly fertile ground in working with somebody around their relationship with money, their financial behaviors, their spending habits, their resistance around certain areas of their life. To take a look at these beliefs, because they have such a profound relationship with how people actually act and their outcomes around money. So that's sort of the exciting part that can bring in. And so there are these beliefs. We quite often inherit them. So we get them from grandparents, great-grandparents. Sometimes we get them from experiences we've had in our lives. Sometimes they come from generations and we have no idea where they came from. But they do have a profound effect on us. So it's an area where a lot of financial planners are finding that there's a lot of benefit to exploring that with some of their clients.
Well, it's interesting. You're saying that this is exciting. So I'm assuming that these are scripts that can be changed. Like a person can alter kind of how they view money.
Absolutely. Yes. So that's the great thing is that our beliefs do have a direct relationship to our outcomes and we can change them. And so that's, I think, and planners do this naturally. Okay. So you are changing people's beliefs every day in your office if you're doing work. So this is a skill set you have. And sometimes that belief changing comes down to presenting new information for them. Like, oh, before I met you, I didn't believe I needed disability insurance. Now I believe I do. So you've just shaped a belief, you know? So it doesn't require an expertise as a psychotherapist to do that. Sometimes it's just simply presenting some of that information. Sometimes it's presenting information to a client, like let's say that you're working with a person who grew up more middle class or lower socioeconomic status. This is one that I see all the time. And they're either entering they're moving up that socioeconomic ladder, or they want to move up that socioeconomic ladder, but they have a real resistance to outsourcing help. You know, it's a miracle they're even talking to you, right? Because they have do-it-yourselfitis, which is a common sort of barrier to entrepreneurial success, people coming from those lower, you know, middle class and below. And so one of the things that you're perhaps doing is educating them on, you know, people who are really successful in business are often doing these things. You know, they often have met with an attorney or a CPA to go over their corporate structure or these tax issues or ways to protect, you know, their intellectual property or whatever it is. You're educating them around this whole other world that they've never really been a part of, and it feels alien and foreign to them. And that's an incredible role that planners can make, is bridging the cultural gap between middle to lower class to upper class in terms of what behaviors people actually engage in, or how people approach investing, for example. All sorts of terrible ideas around how to do that that are proliferating all over social media. We were talking about this before the episode. And so what an incredible opportunity for you to shape some of those beliefs. So when it comes to beliefs around money, people aren't aware of it. They've never really thought about what it was like for them growing up around money and their parents, what they taught them. And, you know, for example, I have these negative beliefs around rich people as a money common money script, like rich people are greedy, money corrupts. So, you know, I'm having some success, but I'm also feeling alienated from my family because there's these negative beliefs around money. And just being aware of that can have a profound impact on somebody's relationship with money and their behaviors moving forward. So that's where you can get a lot of value from digging a little bit deeper into this, their psychology around money.
So they have an awareness. So we ask, you know, I know in my firm, we ask the question of how did your parents relate to money, you know, different things like that. And once they have an awareness, what's the next step? Or is that often enough?
Sometimes awareness is enough. So sometimes you have this aha moment, you know, and I can think of many of these aha moments that have happened with clients and for myself, and you probably can too, where you're like, oh, I hadn't thought of it that way. Boom. Okay. Now I think about it this way from now on, you know?
Yep.
So we have those experiences, those aha moments. Sometimes though, people have the emotional anchor to that belief is so incredibly intense. And I'll give you an example. People who grow up in severe poverty can have this incredibly intense belief that there'll never be enough money. And some of these people go on to amass huge fortunes. You know, my first book was The Financial Wisdom of Ebenezer Scrooge. Great example of somebody who grew up in poverty, had this belief there'll never be enough money, and then ended up basically living a life of poverty, even though he had plenty of money. And so we see this with clients. We see this with a lot of successful clients who have a really hard time spending money on the other side of all that success, or taking care of themselves, or going to the dentist, or God forbid, getting a massage. You know, I always give them that homework assignment, you know, just to sort of expose them to this, you know, the fact that, you know, you don't need to be so miserly. You're making everyone miserable, including yourself. But just as an example of somebody, if you grew up with that type of extreme emotional relationship of not having enough, it can be extremely difficult. So you as a financial planner can be sitting there saying, hey, look, you know, you got $11 million in net worth. You've got $4 million in this trust account. You know, you should be taking some distributions, you know, and it can be really tough for them because they're thinking, well, you know, but if I do that, I'll run out of money. And so for some people like that, where the emotional intensity is so incredibly attached to that belief, that's where I think referring somebody to potentially a therapist can be really helpful, because what you need to do is you need to basically weaken that emotional intensity related to that belief in order to shift the belief. Because people like that, they might know that they have enough money sort of intellectually, but emotionally they're in denial around it because they have so much fear.
Interesting. And so that's what like a therapist would do, is kind of help in that space.
Yes. So you've tried, right? So you've sat there and you said, oh, you've linked this to their past, and maybe they even agree with you. Yes, I know I'm like that. And then you're like, okay, so here's the spending plan. Okay, you're going to take a distribution. I want you to do this. Okay, sounds good. They come back, they, you know, I couldn't do it. You know, I tried, I couldn't do it. Or I was so anxious about that or whatever. And you're seeing them run into those emotional roadblocks. That's where you would want to bring somebody in who is going to, you know, do more psychotherapy work with them around letting them process probably some of that fear. It could involve tears. It could involve much more deeper introspection. There might be some therapeutic elements that are needed in order to shift that behavior.
But I love what you're saying is that those behaviors and those scripts can be shifted.
Absolutely. And it's really exciting when they do, because it leads to profound change and profound improvements in financial health.
In this context, what is your hope for clients when they come and work with you?
Well, it's variable. So it depends on where they're at and what they're needing. But overall, overarching, you know, in my work with clients, I'm wanting to improve their financial health. All sorts of components to financial health. You know, it's of course the basics, like, you know, I want to make sure you're adequately covered in insurance, want to make sure that you're have a good portfolio that meets your needs, all that kind of stuff. So there's those elements too. But I'm very interested in your life satisfaction too. Like I want you to be enjoying your life. I want you to be enjoying your resources. I want you to feel satisfied about your financial life. I want you to have less anxiety around it. I want you to have better, feel like you have good communication with your family around money. So high financial satisfaction too, low financial stress. So for me, it's, you know, that's kind of where the rubber hits the road. I mean, those tools are all great and they're totally necessary. They're part of financial health. But if ultimately you're not improving somebody's life, I mean, I think we're missing out on really what we're meant to do here.
One thing that's been fun watching you is you've had a YouTube channel for 2 years now, year and a half?
Yep, something like that.
Yeah. And so now you've kind of branched out into TikTok and other social medias. And so I'm just curious, first of all, what kind of drove you to start doing more video-based content from YouTube and then on TikTok?
Yeah. So you're kind of, you know, putting me out there on TikTok.
Adding you a little bit.
Right.
He's a little bit of a TikTok star.
Yeah, right. Well, and TikTok's another medium. Like, don't go there and judge me right away, okay? There's a culture over on TikTok.
There is a culture, yes.
Yeah, but, you know, really, so the bottom line for me is, you know, I have this overarching mission statement in my life. You know, my goal is to help bring hope and healing to the world. So I said help, you know, I'm not going to be able to do it all. But everything I do, that's sort of the lens in which I look through it. And it's a great, feel free to adopt that mission statement. I would love it if everyone did, but it makes you feel good, right? So when I'm doing this podcast, for example, I'm picturing advisors out there who might, you know, that I might be able to help them help their clients more. Oh my gosh, I love these opportunities because that's my goal. And so my work really on social media is less about building my practice, quite frankly. And it's more about, I'm sort of picturing me when I was a kid, quite frankly. I grew up lower. My mom says we were middle class, but lower. And I'm like, yeah, mom, they have words for that. but she didn't want to say what they were. But I had, you know, I grew up with a family who were hardworking, really smart people. And I was always curious as a kid, like, you know, why don't we have a name on a building? Why are we living in trailers? You know, these are hardworking people. Some branches been here from the Mayflower. You know, it's like, what's going on? You know, so I got really curious around this psychology that seems to go along in family systems and get passed down. And I got really curious about the psychology of wealth. So one of the things that we've talked about is, you know, I do research on how to improve financial health. I do research on money scripts. The other thing I've done is a lot of research on the psychology of wealth and comparing that to middle class and lower. And like, what can we learn from that to help people shift their behaviors? What sort of stereotypes are either true or untrue? What sort of spending habits keep people stuck because they're misunderstanding what actual wealthy people do? And so we've done several studies on that. So one of the things I try to do, TikTok is actually, I think the audience is younger than a lot of the other social media. So you think high school age kids, a lot of people on there. And I've worked with high school, you know, delinquent type kids for years in my psychology world. I love those kids. But basically what I'm trying to do is educate them on what actual wealthy people do, because social media is full of utter lies around what wealthy people do. So they're being shown, oh, wealthy people, they're all driving Mercedes and BMWs and wearing Rolex watches. And so then what happens is people get their job. Let's say they start to get some success. They're making $100,000 a year. Now they go buy a BMW and then they go buy a bunch of watches. Now they have no money and they have no net worth. and just sort of understanding that that's actually not how wealthy people behave. So for example, I'm always citing this study. We compared ultra wealthy to middle class. The ultra wealthy had an average of like 12 million in net worth. The middle class had 500,000 in net worth. So one of the examples is that the ultra wealthy had 18 times more money in that scenario, but they only spent twice as much as the middle class on things like watches, houses, cars, and vacations. And if you're a financial planner working with ultra wealthy people, you know this to be true. The only way you become ultra wealthy is by saving your money and not spending it. And so a lot of the work we have to do with some of the ultra wealthy people is to get them to spend their money, because this mindset led to their success. But what kids are seeing is they're seeing all the flash, they're seeing, you know, all this stuff. So I feel really passionate about it. You might be hearing this in my voice around educating those kids and society, as many people as I can reach, around what actual wealthy people do. What are these actual habits that are associated with financial health and success, and versus the ones that end up keeping people stuck in this cycle of not having enough money and having a ton of debt.
And, you know, it's so fun because I've been watching you on TikTok and pulling back to like what you were saying earlier about the importance of meeting people right where they're at. I see you doing that in TikTok where you're meeting people right with how they're consuming content. It's the same message, but it's a different package of it.
Yes. And back to your question earlier in our conversation, like how do we talk to clients? The great thing about TikTok for me is that it forces me, like, you've got 15 seconds. So for example, how can you take an issue like compound interest and get 15-year-olds to understand it in 15 seconds while dancing and lip syncing to music? So that's the challenge.
I love it.
That's the challenge. But I will say this too, if you can actually effectively communicate like that, you're going to be a much more effective financial planner in your work. Because a huge gap for us is we have all this technical language and people don't really get it, and that we're missing them. So you have to find ways to make it relatable, really connect that emotional brain. I'm talking even working with genius people. I'm not talking, you know, it's an emotional thing much more than a logical thing. And so to find ways to really meet people where they live is so important if you want to be effective.
I just love that challenge because, I mean, especially when you look on social platforms, how you communicate on Twitter versus TikTok versus Facebook versus Instagram, there's a different culture, I don't know if that's the right word, for each one of those platforms. And we have this message that you're saying, you know, we have this ability to bring hope and healing to people. And it's we can do that. It's just going to look differently. And so it's almost this challenge of like, hey, like, how are we going to take the same message through different channels in different ways of, and help interpret that and into ways that people will actually consume it that they're looking for.
And Hannah, we need to please, everyone who's listening here, please get on these social media platforms and start telling the truth. This is where kids are getting their information. There's an entire generation or two. This is where they're getting all their information. And they're being shown all this crazy stuff and people flashing their private jets and selling them programs on how to flip houses. I don't know if you've been paying attention, but day trading, it's back and it's in vogue and people are doing it on margin and it's insane. And you might not even be aware of that, but this is what's happening on social media. And you know, I thought until I got really deep into it, I thought that was all gone back in, you know, 2000. Oh no, it's back. And people are convinced, they're looking for that one stock to buy and they're just being inundated with all these other people who are essentially predators, who are getting them to buy programs and this kind of stuff by flashing all these cars and watches. And you know, there's probably not much underneath that in terms of their own net worth, but they're trying to sell this misinformation to kids and young adults, and they're lapping it up. And so I want all financial planners to get on social media and really help stem the tide. And actually there's a whole movement of physicians, by the way, who are doing the exact same thing. And you've seen that then too.
On TikTok, yes, the physicians, yes. It's amazing.
It's amazing. Yeah. And what they're educating people, and you got to meet them where they are, and this is where they are. So, you know, get out there, make a fool of yourself. join me in making a fool of yourself, but get out there. And this is where, if you really want to change the world and educate, get on social media and start telling the truth, because people are being told lies there all day long.
So if you join TikTok, let me know. Find me on Twitter. Email me.
Instagram. Yes, let's all connect. Let's all connect on there and support each other. We got to get the message out.
Oh, great. Great stuff. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Brad.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Today's episode is brought to you by Markle. As an investment advisor, you know even the littlest detail can make a huge impact, such as those tiny footnotes in the back of a prospectus or annual report. For your firm's professional insurance coverage, the details are also important. That's why your firm needs insurance coverage developed for financial service professionals to protect you, your firm, and your assets. Markle's Investment Advisors Program offers errors and omissions and directors and officers insurance. They've insured our industry and profession for 3 decades and have a strong reputation within our community as a result of its industry expertise, stable premiums, and excellent claims management services. Markle is proud to be the choice of thousands of financial service professionals. Contact your insurance broker or agent today to get a quote from Markle.
Love what you hear on this podcast? Join us in the FPA Activate Facebook community, where you'll find a community of other passionate planners like you. Not only that, but there are live How We Do What We Do sessions focused on what real financial planning looks like in practice. Be sure to join us there to lend your voice, become a better planner, and help grow the financial planning profession.